The next case for argument is 20-2163, Hunting Titan v. Dyna Energetics Europe. Saunders, whenever you're ready.
May it please the court, my name is Jason Saunders and I'm here representing Hunting Titan. I'd like to start with a discussion of the Presidential Opinion Panel decision on the proposed amended claims. And I think the first thing for us to remember here is these amended claims added only three elements to the original claims: a perforating gun housing, a carrying device for shape charges, and where the detonator assembly is entirely within the perforating gun housing. I think it's critical for us to realize all of...
Our time is short and... I asked too many questions probably, but just to clarify this, the board found the new amended claims were unpatentable over the prior art. The POP, did they ever say the board's reasoning is wrong on that point, or just that the board shouldn't have reached those arguments and that the arguments proposed by you all were wrong?
That is precisely correct, Your Honor.
Right, so the board... As a whole, the POP panel never said these claims are patentable over Schirocker. They're just not unpatentable over the arguments advanced by you.
That's correct. And we believe, I think you've properly identified the general issue here with the POP decision is whether the board can make a decision on patentability of amended claims.
So, again, I get that's your argument. Sorry to cut you short, but here's where I'm struggling with this whole case, which is I read through the POP decision and its general principles of this is when the board can do it, this is when the board doesn't have to do it. And I think you probably would agree there's no requirement to do a scorched earth look at this to determine the new claims, and that the board has discretion, and that the board can place limitations on that discretion. My question is this really just a case about whether the POP panel abused its discretion in not applying this newly announced rule? Because it seems like there's a portion of it that's directly applicable here, which is even if the petitioner didn't raise the argument where the record readily and persuasively establishes that the substitute claims are unpatentable for the same reasons corresponding to the original claims. And it seems like the board said the original claims are unpatentable over Schirocker, and your new amendments don't add anything to get you out of Schirocker. Now, why you didn't make that argument is probably a failing on your part, and whether you get saved for that is a different story. But that seems to specifically address that last exception. And I know this is better directed to your friend sitting there, but why did the POP panel not apply that exception that the record readily discloses that Schirocker still discloses these attempted new claim limitations?
I personally don't understand why they didn't apply that. I think this case is exactly that rare circumstance that the POP identified.
It's very nice that you say that now, but I didn't see that argument made anywhere in the briefs. Your argument was all global. They have to look at it in every case. You didn't take on alternatively, even if the rule is legit, we fall within the rule and they abuse their discretion in that regard. I didn't see you make any argument that sounded like that in the brief. So tell me where it is if I'm missing something.
I can't cite to the exact page of the brief, but I think that's the general principle. We argued that Aqua Products and Nike require that they look at the entirety of the record.
No, but see, this is the problem. Nobody disagrees with that. The board didn't say that they don't have to look at the entirety of the record. They attempted to follow Nike. And they even, if they had said, we will never look outside the petitioner's arguments in response to the motion to amend, even if it's obvious on the record that the new limitations don't make it patentable. If they had said that, they might be in trouble. But they have this loophole that says, if it's readily ascertainable from the record, and it's not patentable over the prior arguments, then they can do that without any argument from you and whatsoever. So I didn't see anything in your blue brief either about this being an abuse of discretion, which is a higher standard. I know you don't want to argue it, but that seems to be the problem here. It might be a substantial evidence case too, but you know, whatever, it's a deferential standard, but is it anywhere in your blue brief that even if the rule is correct, that they still misapplied it?
I don't recall if that's specifically in our brief, Your Honor.
Well, what I recall, and maybe I'm wrong, is that the other side, both green and red, made the argument that you forfeited, said in passing that you forfeited any argument about this. And I didn't recall seeing in gray that you came up and said, no, we didn't. This is our argument.
Well, I think, frankly, it doesn't really matter since the board didn't address the evidence, or I'm sorry, the POP didn't address the evidence and didn't make a finding of patentability based on the entirety of the record. They skipped that entirely. And, I mean, as this court said...
the problem for you is I'm kind of seeing that as a different argument. That argument that you clearly made concerns the board's obligation to consider the entirety of the record, but not whether the specific evidence of anticipation was readily identifiable or persuasive. And it's a big deal, because under the first part, we'd have to strike down the whole reg, or the POP. Under the second argument, the POP lives, it's just a matter of misapplying it. So that really is a big deal in terms of what we're looking at here.
Well, I think we're not looking to strike down the precedential opinion panel as an entity. What we're saying is their decision in this particular case was wrong. Their decision in this case was based on willfully blinding themselves to the evidence. And I think we did say in our brief fairly clearly that the board had already identified that evidence and found it persuasive. So the idea that somehow now later it's not readily identifiable and persuasive enough is an abuse of discretion, and it is arbitrary and capricious because they've refused to look at that evidence. They refused to address the evidence. Instead, contrary to Aqua Products and Nike, they made a decision based solely on an opposition to a motion to amend, and that's improper. And this court found in Nike expressly that the board should not be constrained to arguments and theories raised in the petition or in the opposition to the motion to amend. And the POP expressly said, we're not looking at the petition. It doesn't matter because the claims are different now.
But didn't the board, I mean, there's a little confusion in Nike, is there not? Using the word may and using the word should. And I think the other side argues that not just that it's dicta because the issue is limited, but even language in Nike which says they may do it, which after all was the case before it. It was a question of whether or not the board was allowed to do this, not whether it had to do this. That was the issue in Nike, right?
That's correct.
So if we said, leaving aside the different language that Nike used, if we had said clearly, deciding this case, all we have to decide is whether the board was allowed, may have considered this, and we conclude that yes, they may have. That's not your case, because the board, well, the POP at least didn't. The board may have done it, but the POP didn't.
I think that highlights one of the differences, or one of the issues in our case, which is the POP said, talk to us about two issues. We're going to decide two issues. May we do this? And what kind of notice do we have to give? Nike answered the question clearly, yes, you may. And I think in this quote says you should. It doesn't say you should sometimes go beyond, or you should sometimes or most of the time constrain yourself to this. It says you should not constrain yourself to these limited arguments.
I'm struggling with what the board did here, or the POP panel, let's just call it. I know it because it's different. Because they do have this out, but then they also seem to go back and said, since you didn't, petitioner, you didn't raise these arguments, we're not going to consider them. Did they specifically say, and also, these are not, the grounds of unpatentability found by the board are not readily and identifiable from the record?
No, they did not. They made a critically different statement, which was that they weren't readily identifiable and persuasive enough to justify us bringing them up.
Can you point to where in the POP panel that is to give us some context? I mean, I think I've got your yellow brief up, and I think this paragraph you're talking about, it cites to 52 and 53. Does that sound right?
That sounds right. I'm sorry, I don't believe I have that citation in front of me.
You don't have the POP decision in front of you?
No, I don't.
You all need to bring your stuff here. This is a decision we're reviewing.
Well, they did. I mean, in response to, I'll answer Judge Hughes' question since I do have the POP panel. I mean, it does say at 52, they did seem to analyze that it's readily, why it's not readily identifiable and persuasive.
But I think they also said, I mean, I think their ultimate conclusion was that it wasn't readily identifiable and persuasive enough, which is a different question than is it readily identifiable and persuasive. And I think the board clearly found it readily identifiable.
Well, they said this is far from sufficient, which I think is a fair way to apply the standard, right?
I mean, this turns this into a completely different case if we're talking about whether the board has either abused its discretion or lacks substantial, the POP panel has abused its discretion or lacks substantial evidence in applying this rule, rather than the articulation of the rule itself is inconsistent with the statute and our interpretation of the statute in Nike.
I think that's correct, and I don't think we're not trying to make the argument that the rule itself is an abuse of discretion or inconsistent. What we're arguing is that in this particular case, they did not make a decision on patentability. The POP did not, based on the entirety of the record. They limited themselves just to the opposition to the motion to amend.
Again, let me back up, because I want to be clear about this. Let's assume they don't have to do that in every instance. They can, and they have discretion, and then the POP panel puts some limits on that discretion. And one of the limits is the board can't raise new arguments about patentability on new claims unless it's the sort of whatever, that readily identifiable language. Let's assume that limitation on the board's discretion is okay. Then doesn't the fact that they've referenced that limitation and said, well, that doesn't show it enough, so the board should not have exercised its discretion here. Doesn't that turn it into whether there's substantial evidence supporting that decision or abuse of discretion? I don't know. This is a new issue, so I don't think we've discussed what standard applies to it, but it would be one of those two.
I think that's correct, but I think in this particular case, where the board has already identified the evidence and found it persuasive, what the POP did was contrary to Nike and Aqua Products to willfully blind itself to the evidence.
See, but that's the problem. I think you're arguing this in an incorrect way. It baffles me that the POP panel came in and said, look, the board's already found these unpatentable over the prior art. We're not going to say they're wrong on that. We're just going to say they shouldn't have done that. That's baffling. But if they're allowed to put in place a rule that limits the board's discretion when to do that, and this case falls into that discretion, then what you need to be arguing is that the POP panel abused its discretion in not allowing the board to exercise its discretion, I think, rather than the POP panel should have looked at the whole record, because the rule they announced doesn't require anybody to look at the whole record in every single case. It allows the board to have discretion to look at it in certain instances, and they determined it didn't fall within that instance.
So I think this is a difference here where the POP and the patent owner want to say this is about new arguments. And it's not really about new arguments. This has been the same argument.
I agree and entirely with you, but you didn't argue the case that way. You know, the facts are the board found these unpatentable. And again, it baffles me why the POP would want to let these, in the solicitor's office would now want to let claims go forward that are clearly unpatentable or the prior art as determined by three of its expert judges. But they're allowed to do that. And you didn't argue that it was an abuse of discretion for the POP panel. You're trying to say they shouldn't have done that as a matter of law. But they're allowed to do that as a matter of law if that POP panel decision and the new rule are correct.
The POP panel, the United States Patent Office, they don't have the discretion to decide not to review the entirety of the record. That's what Aqua Products and Nike said.
Well, I don't think that's what those cases say. You're stating it in the negative. The cases say they have the discretion to review the record and raise grounds of patentability, but I don't think they say there's an affirmative obligation to do some kind of full look at the entire record and do kind of their own determination of patentability.
So, I mean, what Aqua Products said is the final substantive decision must be based on the entirety of the record. Basic principles of administrative law compel this conclusion.
Okay.
Anything else? We'll reserve your rebuttal time. You've already used it up.
I think I would just point out that in this case, the notice requirements were satisfied per Nike. This was ground one of the IPR. The patent owner addressed it in their motion to amend and at the hearing. We think they clearly had notice of this. Thank you.
Thank you.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court. I'd like to clearly separate the two issues there are in this case. First, the standard that the POP established from when the board may raise its own grounds of unpatentability. And the second, then, is the specific application of the standard to the specific facts of this case. And I hear this Court would like to discuss the second, some concerns about the application in this case. So I'll start there.
Well, can you start with, because I'm a little concerned, too, about, I think find this a little unclear about what discretion the POP panel and your new regulation are giving the board. And it is, are they confining the board to arguments raised by the petitioner, either in the petition or in the reply to the motion to amend? Or is this last part, what I keep calling the safety valve, does that let board members say, even if nobody has argued this before, in the petition or the like, if it goes to the same grounds and is readily apparent from the record, the board has the discretion to raise that. Is it that they're allowed to do, the latter?
Yes, they are allowed. The POP decision makes clear that when there's a failure of the adversarial process, when the board thinks that the best arguments and evidence haven't been brought by the parties, that the board may.
So hypothetically, if you have original claims, the board finds them anticipated by one prior art reference and says all the limitations are disclosed in here. The patent owner says, well, I want to amend, I'm going to add these three new limitations. And, you know, the petitioner doesn't drop out, they file a reply, but it's insufficient or doesn't respond. But the board can still look at the prior art reference, look at the limitations, and say, these limitations are still in that prior art reference. Can the board do that?
Yes, the board may do that under the POP decision and the regulation.
Okay, I actually have to pull back a minute. Let's just talk about discretion, because I'm completely unclear about what the discretion is under the POP opinion. Firstly, the most obvious, the POP opinion, as I understand it, says if the petitioner has dropped out or if he or she has not responded, then the board goes forward and does its relatively searching review. Is that discretionary or is that a rule? If the petitioner is gone, is the board obligated to do its own search, or is the POP panel saying only, well, it's up to the board. If they want to, they can. If they don't want to, they don't have to.
I think looking to the regulation that's now in effect, the POP panel doesn't say one way or the other, but looking to the regulation that went into effect in January, the discretion has been limited to only when there's readily identifiable and persuasive evidence on the record. And that would be the policy of the board staying their discretion is to encourage the parties to remain in and oppose the motion.
So, wait a minute. So just let me be clear, because I actually thought the answer was different. If there's no petitioner, or if the petitioner doesn't respond,
right,
is the board required to do a review? If your answer is no, then my question is, so what are the limitations? Is it completely within their discretion? Do we then apply this readily identifiable thing? I understood the POP to say there are these two categories, no petitioner,
yes,
board has to act. Then there's this other category when the petitioner is an active participant, and then if he doesn't raise the right stuff, the board can add this different stuff. You're telling me something different, right?
Well, there is a regulation now that is in effect. The regulation doesn't dictate this case, and the POP panel doesn't get to what the board should do when there's not a petitioner in the case because the petitioner was in the case and did oppose the motion to amend.
So you're saying under the reg?
Right. So the reg does limit the board's discretion to readily identifiable and persuasive evidence.
Even when the petitioner has dropped out?
That's correct. The regulation reads, in the interest of justice, the board may exercise its discretion to raise a ground based on readily identifiable and persuasive evidence. That regulation isn't before this court.
Can you clarify, does it have to raise it if it's readily identifiable? Well, or does it, so it's completely discretionary.
It's
so a board can look at this, in back to my hypothetical, and look at it and say, it's clear to us that these aren't patentable over the same prior art that was cited, but we're just not going to raise it in our discretion.
Well, I think the board does want to do the right
thing.
But you're right. It is discretionary. It's set up as discretionary, but the goal is that the parties will be incentivized to participate in the adversarial process because there's nothing
what
in the AIA.
What about the goal of making sure only valid claims are issued?
That is
Isn't
correct.
Isn't that more important than the goal of having parties participate?
But the point of the AIA is to be a party-driven process and giving the incentive to the parties to bring the best
so
evidence.
You're saying
and argument.
That under the regulation, I'm sorry, I'm still overwhelmed by this. Under the regulation, if the petitioner has dropped out, the board can maybe look at it. But even if there is readily identifiable information, and even if the petitioner has dropped out, the board still has the discretion to say, interest of justice, nah, we're not going there. And presumably, that would never be reviewable, because if the petitioner has dropped out, nobody's there to appeal it. So the board has the complete, unfettered, unreviewable discretion to do that, even when and therefore issue the amendment, even when the petitioner has dropped out. In other words, no one has made a case for the amendment.
That's how the regulation sets it up. The regulation is not before the court. It is the POP panel right now, and the POP panel doesn't decide for when a petitioner has dropped out because the petitioner was still in this case. Again, the policy decision of the regulation and the POP panel is to incentivize parties to participate in this process.
Let me ask you then about how the POP panel works. So, since we're not dealing with when a petitioner drops out. In this case, and I think maybe you've already discussed this with Judge Hughes, and I apologize, but under the POP panel, are they saying that even if there is readily identifiable information, it's completely within the unreviewable discretion of the board to decide whether they want to do any kind of review with respect to the prior art relevant to the amendment?
The POP panel is dealing with a situation where the petitioner filed the opposition to a motion to amend, and is that the board may raise its own grounds of patentability despite that opposition when there's readily identifiable and persuasive evidence on the record.
May or may not?
May do its raise its own grounds.
It may do it. No, that's my question. But does the POP panel say that it's completely within the discretion of the board, even when there's readily identifiable information, whatever that phrase is? Does the POP panel mean that even if that exists, the board still has the discretion to say, forget it, never mind?
Well, like your honor says, we'll never know. We should take the board as doing its job, and it may raise these grounds, and I think overall the board again, wants to get the answers right, and the idea of incentivizing the parties is that the parties will bring the best arguments and evidence.
You keep saying incentivizing the parties, but I see very obvious scenarios where it would incentivize the parties not to do this, which is a patent owner has a specific petitioner that they're suing in court, and they don't want to lose their patent, so they proposed claim limitations that they know will now make the infringer non-infringing. And the infringer has no interest in going forward with the IPR, so they drop out, and they get these new claims issued because there's no obligation of the board to go forward. Which you say the board has no obligation, even if the record affirmatively, like 100%, the limitations are minor, insubstantial, covered by the prior art. You say the board doesn't have to look at that.
The board has the discretion, and I think this is a small scenario of cases. Most of petitioners oppose the motions to amend. And this
it's
public
not that
is still
small of a scenario, though. We get cases up here all the time where the petitioner has dropped out for various reasons. Either they've settled or the amended claims probably don't. We don't know why they've dropped out, but it happens. You know, you guys come in and participate in these cases all the time where the petitioner's dropped out. So to say that it's not something that's common is not really supported, and it seems really problematic that you could, I don't want to say game the system, but you can use these rules to put in place amended claims without any test at all as to whether they're patentable.
Well, there is a test. The board is there, and though it
yes, but you say now they have complete discretion instead of if they're readily discernible. If what was the issue was every time there's an amendment, the board has an obligation to search the record and make sure they're patentable over the entire record. I don't think that's what we meant if we said that in Aqua Products, and I don't think that's right. But you know, that's a different thing. But if it's readily ascertainable, whatever language you're using here, it seems like the board should have an obligation to do that, at least that minimal searching. But you're saying no, that it's completely discretionary.
Well, I think there's nothing in the AIA that requires any particular search by the board or any particular analysis. And the POP and the regulation make a policy choice that it's better to incentivize the parties and that the board will then make better decisions overall when the petitioner doesn't know.
But isn't it implicit when the board allows amended claims to go out that they should be, the agency should consider them patentable? That they should have at least checked them at some minimal level?
Well, I think the board is going to take that responsibility on it. They don't, it's a may, but I don't know how this court polices a should or a have to. And when there is the evidence on the record, that's
but
of the same.
Totally, if we say that there's a duty to perform this, whatever this exception, this ascertainable thing is, if that's not a may, but it's a should, then if you don't do it and it gets raised somehow, then we can determine whether your decision not to do it was supported by substantial evidence or abuse of discretion, whatever standard we determine, but it's certainly judicially reviewable.
Well, I think if the board does raise, whether the board raises it and it has to, and then the petitioner's petition fail, like they oppose and they fail, they're always going to come to this report, well, they should have raised readily identifiable and persuasive evidence. We didn't recognize it, but they should have raised it. So it sort of undermines, any should is going to undermine any of forfeiture principles for the petitioner.
Okay, I know I'm repeating myself and this is probably, I just want to really make sure I understand what you're saying. Even if Blue, in this case, had made the argument that this was an abuse of discretion in its application, because of this other standard, you would say, no, that's not possible. Because even if the POP said this was readily identifiable, even if they concluded this was readily identifiable, they could have decided not to reach it.
Well,
and a court would have nothing to say on that.
Once the panel decision reached it, what the POP was saying is asking the question of whether they should have, whether this was readily identifiable and persuasive. The POP didn't say, you didn't have to do anything and you shouldn't have done anything. They said this wasn't readily identifiable and persuasive evidence and thus you should not have exercised your discretion to raise it. But that's a different question than if they hadn't raised anything, or just saying you should never have raised it because we say you don't have to raise anything. They are reviewing then the panel articulation of readily identifiable and persuasive and finding in this case that the panel, it's not readily identifiable and persuasive based on the way the panel had
to. And once they do that, that's reviewable by us under some standard.
Right, so you can...
You're not arguing that that's wholly insulated from review once they make it.
Right, so if Hunting Titan had argued that the POP misapplied its standard in this case, that is reviewable by the
I mean,
court.
Can you address that, though? I mean, the board seemed to do exactly what the POP panel said they should do, which is, you know, or were allowed to do. Not said they had to, but were allowed to do. I'm a little baffled as to why the POP panel said the board's exercise of discretion wasn't correct here. It didn't seem like they looked outside the record. It didn't seem like they went beyond saying, look, all this is still in Chiracker. Why is that not covered in the readily identifiable exception?
So there's two underlying reasons that the POP gave. One, that just on the face of Chiracher, it doesn't say that there's a housing that completely contains the detonator, because the panel put together not what is called the housing in Chiracher, but the connector 30, which is been mapped
but
by...
But it's all in Chiracher. They
right,
didn't
it
go
is.
Elsewhere.
But it's
so
been
they
mapped.
Found it readily identifiable from Chiracher.
Well, they're saying it wasn't readily identifiable and persuasive from Chiracher.
But the
because
was.
You... Well, the panel didn't have the standard, but we'll assume that they did because they raised it. But the connector was already housed.
Can I just ask you this, just to clarify what's in my mind, what is the result of this? The POP panel didn't affirmatively say these are patentable over Chiracher, did they? They just said the arguments raised by the petitioner are insufficient, and we're not going to allow the board to make the arguments it made.
We're not going to let the panel raise its own ground. Not that these claims were found to be anticipated.
Why is it its own ground when it's the same reference?
I guess it's because it's their own ground.
It's
that
just different parts of the same.
Yes.
We go back and forth with everybody in these IPRs all the time when it's a new argument or it's just further evidence in the same prior art reference to support the same anticipation ground. This seems to be clearly in the latter. The board... It's not the original arguments against the original claims, but it's the same prior art reference. And they said, look, we're going to read this prior art reference, and nothing you added here is good enough to overcome that. And maybe they didn't preserve this argument well enough, but it seems really frustrating that if the board was right, that these claims are going to go out in the world when the board found them invalid and nobody's disagreed with that.
Yes, I hear your frustration. I understand that. I think the POP... saying not that we the agency know these claims are anticipated, because there was the APA problem with notice to DynaEnergetics about the specific way that the panel rearranged the elements of Chiracher. So there's not a panel decision that just decided anticipation consistent with the APA, and that there had to be a reinterpretation of Chiracher, and also that Hunting Titan's arguments about Chiracher never themselves saw this as readily identifiable as a way to meet that limitation.
Can I just add a clarity just on Nike and on the relevance of Nike? Going forward, in Nike, the board itself said, we're going to review this, we're going to find this. And we said, fine, you may do that, not you shall. Following POP, the board panels will not be allowed to do that, correct?
Do raise their own grounds. They will. They have the discretion.
Only if it's readily identifiable, right?
Right. It's readily identifiable.
Now, Nike didn't limit that, and in Nike, yeah. I think you could make an argument that it was certainly the prior art references were certainly less readily identifiable than they were in this case. That's fair, isn't it?
It may be fair. No one has applied that standard to the particular facts of Nike.
So if we disagree with the POP panel and said these were readily identifiable, assuming there's no, I mean, I have some problems with the way it was argued, but assuming that that had been the argument, the POP panel was wrong and these were readily identifiable, can we do something about that? Can we say, POP panel, we disagree with you, the board was right to raise these, they were readily identifiable?
Yes, this court can say that. I think then that's when the notice issue comes into
play. Okay, but let's set that aside
okay.
too.
Okay.
I understand.
But in the future case here, is that only because the POP panel decided to dive in? In a future case, the POP panel or another panel could say, well, we're not even going to look at whether or not it's readily identifiable or not. So we'll not, there's nothing to review in terms of the readily identified. And in a future case, that would be fine. I mean, under what standard could we review that?
Well, I think that what is going to happen in the future is when the board wants to raise its own ground, it's going to raise that ground and give the parties notice of that ground.
What's going to happen in the future if the board doesn't want to raise its own ground?
Well, then...
Even if it's readily identifiable, what happens in those cases?
Then the parties argue what the board decided, unless there's a duty for the board that they have
to... No, but just tell me that case. We have that case. The board says... in this case, but let's assume the board, rather than reaching the issue, says, or the board panel says, we're not even going to look at whether or not it's readily identifiable. We're moving on. Can the petitioner appeal that? And what argument can the petitioner make? Can he make an abuse of discretion argument? But where's the discretion if you're saying the board has discretion to decide or not to decide without any criteria or limits? So there can be no abuse of discretion under that theory, right?
I mean, the petitioner may argue that even though they didn't raise it, that somehow they might try to argue that it was readily identifiable, and then the court and the board had to raise it, should have raised it. But if it's discretionary, that argument should fail. There should be forfeiture for the petitioner when they fail to raise
arguments. In other words, your reading of POP is that it's completely within the discretion of the panel, even if it's readily identifiable, to decline to apply that until just like... I get a yes or no on that?
Yes, it's discretionary. The board is going to decide the parties...
What difference? If your view is it's completely discretionary, what difference does it make if petitioner raised it or not? If it's completely discretionary and unreviewable by us, then whether they raise that argument seems to be... It doesn't save them on appeal.
The petitioner, that's correct. Yeah. Right. If it is discretionary as opposed to a duty.
I think that you've already answered this, but if you answer what I thought you did, I am astounded that you're taking this position. But original claims out, amended claims proposed, petitioner says no good, it's readily identifiable from the record that they're still not patentable. Mm-hmm. And the board just says, no, we're not going to look at that question. Not that addressing it just says, no, we're going to exercise our discretion not to look at that question. On appeal to us, is that decision reviewable?
Yes. If the petitioner raises it and says these are readily identifiable, the petitioner is making the argument themselves, and then the board will review the petitioner's opposition.
What's the legal basis for the board having to make respond to that argument?
Because when the board is still going to review an opposition to the motion to then with the petitioner having the burden of proof.
If the petitioner
doesn't just says it's readily identifiable, you board go do it for me.
No. Let's just assume they made the right argument. Okay. In that case, you're saying the board has an obligation to consider the argument.
Yes, because the petitioner made the argument. It's no longer whether the board may itself raise
the
ground.
Then it's not wholly discretionary about the board's readily identifiable
point.
You're saying it's wholly discretional only if the petitioner doesn't raise it, but if they do, then it's not discretionary.
Right, they have to decide.
What makes the sense of that? I mean, because it's the same standard applies in both circumstances, right? The board is going to look at whether, let me just ask this the other way. Why shouldn't we just say, there is an obligation for the board to look at and use this readily identifiable standard whether or not the petitioner raises it because of the fact that these are new claims and there should be at least a minimal check on whether they're patentable or not. Why shouldn't we do that? Because you seem to say in one circumstances the board's required to do that and in one circumstances it's not.
Well, I think there's two issues. This is just about when the board should sua sponte itself raise the ground. If all the grounds the petitioner raises.
No, I don't understand what makes why you wouldn't. If you're going to say the board has the discretion to do this, then shouldn't they have the discretion to do this and actually have to do this in all cases? Like, why would they do it just to confront a petitioner's argument and then say, well, we could figure this out because it's easy, but we're not going to do it?
I think I'm a little confused because when the petitioner is opposing the motion to amend, petitioner bears the burden on that, and the board is going to decide that motion on the arguments that the parties make. So that all still is in place. This is just the board's discretion when the petitioner's not there or when they think the petitioner has missed an argument that's readily identifiable and
I still don't understand what the distinction is. Even if the petitioner doesn't participate at all, there's still a motion to amend that the board has to consider and grant. And in granting that motion to amend, don't they have to make at least some threshold determination that the new claims are patentable over the prior art that's already been asserted?
Right. They have to make, under 318A, there's a requirement to make a determination of patentability. The board may raise grounds that are readily identifiable and persuasive on the evidence and then has to itself justify any of those grounds of unpatentability when the petitioner drops out. But if there's an obligation to do so, I don't know where that is in the AIA. This is a line drawing and there's no perfect answer for where to draw the line, but the policy the agency is trying to get at is to incentivize the parties to bring the evidence to them, since this is not supposed to be an agency-led process, but a party-driven office.
But if the petitioner has settled or dropped out, and it's not affected by the motions to amend, I mean, I can't find it now, but I thought even in the POP opinion, the board took out instances where the petitioner has dropped out or is not responding, and recognized that it had a responsibility for the public interest
in
doing some sort of analysis. And now you're telling me that was true, that if that's true then, it's not true anymore because under the regulation there's no such obligation. Our only obligation is to try to foster an adversarial system, not to protect the public from issuing patents that may not be patentable.
I mean, the idea is that will encourage...
Am I right about that? Is that correct?
The idea is it'll encourage better arguments and better decisions by the boards overall, even if in the cases where the petitioner drops out, it's still the individual case.
So the public interest is protected only at the whim of petitioner's counsel and the competency of the petitioner's counsel. I'm not speaking to this case, but there are probably cases out there, you've probably seen them, where petitioner's counsel may not be particularly competent. And why should we rely on, you know, the random draw of petitioner's counsel and their ability to protect the public against facially invalid claims when the board could do it itself?
I mean, I think Congress did set up a party-driven process.
Well, you say that, but what you had to do with motions to amend is very thin. I mean, they didn't say anything about, specifically relying on the adversarial process. This is all coming from the POP's view of what it should be.
That is correct.
Well, why did that? What was the purpose of the AIA? Was it not to get the board to take a second look at questionable patents?
Yes.
Wasn't the purpose to have the ability for the board to re-examine or take another look at those patents
so we can
get rid of patents that shouldn't have been issued in the first instance?
And putting the burden on the petitioner made it a party-driven system. And even when the motion to amend is granted, the public still has the advantage of narrower and clarified claims. There's intervening rights. This has been a re-look at the claims that had issued, and they're not the claim. If a motion to amend is granted, they are narrower.
But there are new claims being issued as a result of this amendment.
There are claims that overcome the prior art from the petition that was asserted against the original claims, and those are narrower. They have to be narrower claims that clarify that clarify what the patent owner thinks is their invention.
The bottom line of what I'm hearing is that the board does not have to do anything beyond looking at what the petitioner says in its opposition, or if the petitioner says nothing because it's gone, the board doesn't have to do anything. Am I hearing that right?
It is a discretionary. Yes, it's discretionary.
A discretion means the board doesn't have to do anything.
The board doesn't have to do
anything. Are there standards upon which we would evaluate an abuse of discretion? Because I'm not hearing any. If it's completely discretionary, are there any standards against which we would review this?
Well, I mean, I don't think the patent owner gets their motion to amend, there's no one that's going to bring the cases to this court the petitioner, if it's a should, the petitioner is going to say not only they misapplied our motion, but they also should have raised these grounds that were readily identifiable. They have this duty and they didn't do it for us. So this court.
And you say, no, we have no duty. It's completely discretionary.
Right. It is when the petitioner bears the burden on the motion to amend. And if there's a duty on the board, that would undermine any forfeiture principles on the petitioner for what grounds that it chooses to raise. And the idea is that that's going to undermine the incentives for the petitioner to raise what they think are the best arguments and evidence. If the board's going to step in and decide it on the prior art that was in the petition every time for them, they have different incentives. And the policy choice is to incentivize the parties. And there's no perfect line. I understand that wherever you draw the line, there's going to be difficulties. If you say the board always has to do it, that's going to be hard to administer. But I don't know what the in-between is other than it's discretionary to put the burden on the petitioner. And the board...
Do you think Congress really gave you the policy choice between incentivizing litigation and the adversarial system versus making sure that only valid patents were out there in the world? I mean, it seems like the whole point of the AIA was to allow challenge is to patents that should never have been issued in the first place. Shouldn't that go also, that policy purpose, go to amended claims?
And I think it is going to amended claims. It is
that is the primary purpose, then the rule you're proposing does not align with that, as well as a should consider rather than can consider.
I think it's aligned with the purpose of the AI in that it's getting the parties to give us the best arguments and evidence, because we have to do this. The board has to do this in the year timeframe. They have limited resources. The Congress's purpose was to harness the power of the third parties to bring the best arguments and evidence to the board so that the board will make better decisions in the overall, even if in this particular case you think that the best decision is not being made. And if you let the board step in, the petitioner is going to have different incentives. And there's no perfect answer.
Do you really think so? I mean, aren't the petitioners always, if the patent is still going to be, new claims are going to be enforced against them, aren't they still going to have the incentives to make the best arguments they can?
One would hope, and I think this encourages it, makes sure that they know there's not going to be...
But you don't need this rule to incentivize them. What it does is allow for the board to allow bad claims to go forward when they don't do a very good job.
In those individual cases, but overall, the idea is that it will incentivize people to bring the best arguments to the board so that they will make good decisions overall.
I don't understand why you need that rule to incentivize petitioners to make their best arguments. Do you think they're going to come in and say, we're not going to make very good arguments here because the board's going to do it itself?
They may think the board's going to do a certain amount for it and then we'll focus on new art and bring new art into the policy
that's
choice.
Fair.
Can I ask you just a housekeeping question, kind of like, do you know the statistics on this? On taking past year, whatever, how many motions to amend there are, if there are any that have been done under POP, if there are any that have been adjudicated under the new regulation?
So the only public data they have, and this is on our website, ends in, I think, March 2020. It's 10%.
March 2020? You've got to have updated it for a year. Your website was always so up to date.
Yeah, this was a special study. It's not part of the year, just the quarterly study that's done. Before March 2020, it was 10% of cases had motions to amend. Two-thirds of those were decided on the merits as opposed to being decided because the original claims were found to be not unpatentable or a settlement. So there's two-thirds of the 10% are actually being decided on the merits. And we don't have any data on how many of those were opposed, though.
But since March 2020, I don't have any, which is over a year, the PTO doesn't maintain any data on that?
We don't have any data on the motions to amend. There is a pilot program now to increase the number of motions to amend, so patent owners will file more motions to amend so that they can get feedback from the board on a motions to amend and respond to feedback from the board. And I don't have any public data on how motions to amend have changed.
I don't understand. What does feedback mean?
So there's a pilot program. It's obviously way off the case, but where the patent owner can file and get feedback, they file their motion to amend and get feedback from the board and then refile in response to the board before the board decides the motion to amend.
Well, did you say that the board did that because it was trying to incentivize more motions to amend?
Yes, I think the agency was concerned that patent owners didn't feel like they had a chance to amend their patents, and the AIA does set out it as a right
well,
to
how,
amend.
Well, if the board doesn't have any statistics, at least for almost the last year and a half, how does it make a determination that they're not enough motions to amend? We need to incentivize them. Well, we know there were 90% of the cases.
There's only 10% of the cases there were a motion to amend.
That was as of March 9th, 2020.
I don't have, I'm sorry, Your Honor.
That was before the POP. Maybe the POP incentivized enough people to file motions to amend.
I'm sorry, Your Honor, I don't have any statistics on that.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honors.
Now, the split time didn't work out so well. So I don't think, Mr. Herman, speaking only for myself, we need to retread the ground already tread. So were you going to talk about the actual case here?
I would love to. And in fact, I understand that this court has, global implications, but under the facts of what happened here, I think it's clear that the POP, this was a request for rehearing, Judge Hughes, and on page 21 of the POP decision, the POP did find that there is not the sort of readily identifiable and persuasive evidence of anticipation in the record that would justify the board raising its own grounds of unpatentability. And then it points to the portion of Chakra that was relied on by the original panel and says this is far from sufficient. Though the board decision interpreted Chakra's connector 30 to act as a single housing with housing 26, this interpretation is not clearly stated by Chakra and does not rise to the level.
So is that conclusion reviewable by us? And if
it
so,
is.
What standard is it reviewable under?
Well, I mean, I look at this as the board. I mean, first of all, this is the only POP decision. They've only taken one case after a final written decision. This was it. There's been four others, one more recent, and it's all on institution decisions. I mean, you said you were frustrated because, if it's clearly anticipated, these claims are going to get out there. And I look at it as we were completely shocked because we don't think the original claims are invalid, which hopefully I'll have time to get to. But here, the whole argument at oral argument, Your Honor, was about obviousness. And I said to the judge,
sure, sure. There might be a notice issue here. There might not be. Let's leave that aside. That's not what I asked. I'm not asking about notice. I'm not asking about whether this is or not. I'm asking about whether when the POP said this is not a permissible way for the board to look at these new claims, if that's reviewable by us, what standard we review it under, and what authority do you have for all of that?
So the POP not only, this is why I went to the obviousness thing I'm getting, the POP not only ruled that Chakra did not anticipate the amended claims, it ruled that there
was... Wait, be careful, right? Because they didn't say that Chakra didn't anticipate the amended claims. They said the ground relied upon by the board was one that the board should not have raised, right?
I understood, Your Honor.
They didn't say the ground relied upon the board was wrong, did they?
Well... The language they use is that it's not readily identifiable.
Right. So they didn't disagree with the board. They said you shouldn't have raised it.
Well,
they went on and said the arguments raised by the petitioner for unpatentability are incorrect.
So, Your Honor, backing up a couple pages in the POP decision, they said, and I know you want to do something more globally, but here, Hunting Titan chose not to assert anticipation. And the POP took that into account and said, because petitioner affirmatively chose not to raise this.
I understand. Look, we've talked about this. We know what's going on. I just want to try to get an answer to my question,
yes.
Which is the board, even though this exception wasn't in place, let's just assume that this was the type of action they were undertaking that fell within that readily identifiable exception. The POP disagreed and said, no, it didn't. So you said we get to review that decision. What standard review do you think should apply to the POP's decision to reject the board's reasoning, and what authority do you have that we get to review it at all, and what the standard is?
I think you would rely, this would be, you could rely under, or you could review it under abuse of discretion, or you could do substantial evidence, because this is the, does Shock, is there substantial evidence in the record that Shockerer is readily identifiable? You'd have to kind of shoehorn it in, I guess. But what the board, what the POP did here is they looked at the record, and can I get to the merits, or I want to answer your question though.
So, no, you answered it.
Okay. The merits here.
I mean, you didn't answer me what precedent you were relying on for that, but that's probably because there isn't. We're probably making this up as it goes along.
I'm not sure. I don't know off the top of my head, Your Honor, what the.
I was hoping you would tie it back into Nike, but.
Well, Nike does say that the board may raise this argument. And when you were asking my colleague, Ms. Craven, about that, when in these situations when the petitioner has either dropped out or isn't opposing the motion to amend, I think it's clear that the POP decision is saying we should look more carefully and the board should look more carefully in those situations as opposed to the situation we have here. I get that it's discretionary, but Your Honors, I mean, what we have here with Shockerer, and this goes to the original claims, which we've appealed. Shockerer has this huge sub that connects two perforating guns together, and it put the detonator, the wire, if they want to call it wireless, into the sub so that the guns could rotate, okay? It's a fine invention. It has nothing to do with what DynaEnergetics invented on the 422 patent.
I'm sorry to interrupt. I know time is short, and trust us. I hope you appreciate. We've read the briefs.
Understood.
We
Thank
understand
you,
the issues.
I'm
so
here
let me
to
just
answer
ask
questions.
You an argument, that, a question that I really need to
yes.
answer. There's a requirement in the regs that the patent owner has to show that a proposed substitute claim responds to a ground of unpatentability involved in the trial. You familiar with that
422.121? Yes,
what does that actually require in practice? Because if that's the requirement, I would read that if you have to respond to a ground of unpatentability involved in the trial, there was a ground of unpatentability, which is sharer anticipation, why would the obligation not have been under the reg to deal with that issue?
We did deal with that issue, in fact.
But you agree that the reg, and I should have asked this to the PTO, and I'm sorry I didn't, and maybe I can think about asking her to come back. But their obligation to respond. So even though we've talked about burdens and a lot of people have said a lot of things about burdens, it seems to me their obligation is to respond. So you have to put that in play. You put that in play. So it's in play by the time the board looks at it. So
it was in play here, Your Honor. We said specifically in our motion to amend that Shocker didn't anticipate the new claims. We said we don't believe Shocker anticipates the original claims, but we've made it clear, we've added this language, and we've made it much clearer as to what is being covered, and Shocker doesn't anticipate that. The claims also have to be narrower.
So in your view, you put before the board the question of whether or not Shocker anticipates the amended claims, and that's the issue that was before the board, right?
That's the way we read the rule, which is to say you have to address an issue of patentability that's been raised. And so we said specifically, these claim limitations take it outside of Shocker. Hunting Titan agreed and that they asserted obviousness.
But the board disagreed.
Which is amazing. Your Honor, I know you're shocked, but it's shocking that Hunting Titan, with sophisticated patent counsel, would look at the claim limitations and say, we're not even going to assert anticipation anymore. And the board on its own says, hold on.
Why is that shocking? The board's filled with expert judges that do this over and over again. And they're embedded in this case, in this reference. And they see your limitations and are like, we've read Shocker. This doesn't do it for us.
They read Shocker so broadly, Your Honor, that it completely.
No, but I get that. So that's a merits question, though.
Okay.
So, but we're still, I know you want to get onto the merits. But it confounds me when the regulation requires you to bear at least some minimal burden initially, which suggests that the board has to look at whether you met that burden, and the board says you haven't met that burden. Why the POP panel suddenly takes that whole activity away and says the board can't do this at all? Why isn't that at least an abuse of discretion on the facts of this case?
I would take issue, Your Honor, with saying the POP said that you can't do this at all. They said you can do it if it's readily identifiable and persuasive evidence. And for the POP to take
away...
Go ahead.
I'm going to stop asking this question, but does that mean we get to review the POPs panel's decision that this is not readily identifiable for abuse of discretion? And if we disagree with them and find that they abuse their discretion, that the board's decision could stand?
I think in this circumstance, I don't believe that Hunting Titan raised that argument, so I don't. I think they've waived that argument. But in and you won't have another POP decision.
Okay,
yes.
Setting aside the waiver, could we?
Yeah, I think you
you're
could.
Not, we're not going to have. The problem is POP wanted to establish a rule, and this is the best case they had, but it's
the best
case.
Yeah.
Going forward, we're not going to, presumably, I mean, if it happens again, we'll see, but presumably when the board exercises its discretion and says this is readily identifiable, that's going to be fact specific and the POP panel is not going to say, no, we disagree with you.
Correct. It would just be appealed. You would think that then the patent owner would appeal that to the Federal Circuit, and then you could then determine that case on the merits.
So even if the POP decision is wrong here on whether it's readily identifiable, it's kind of a one-off.
I think that's right. I would say this. The fact that the POP took this case and made this ruling shows you how egregious this panel was. And so, yes, I am still trying to get to the merits of this case, but I think the best case for the POP to have taken, Judge Hughes, would be to take a situation where the petitioner dropped out, and then the board went ahead on their own and found something unpatentable, and then the POP would have said that's okay, because this is one of those rare circumstances because they dropped out. I see I've gone over my time. I had saved 3 minutes for rebuttal, if that's still okay.
Yeah, that would only apply to your cross appeal. The other side decides to use its time responding to it.
Thank you, Your Honor.
All right. We'll give you 5 minutes.
Thank you, Your Honor. I'll try to keep it very brief. First, responding to Judge Hughes' point, this is one of those cases where the amendments take the accused device outside the claims. It's not a rare circumstance. It happens all the time. And
I don't understand what you just said.
So this IPR is the result
the amendment
of
they're proposing, the patent owner proposed, take it outside
Take the accused product in the associated litigation outside
sorry.
Of the claims.
Right, okay. That's fine.
It's a minor issue. I only address it because you raised it earlier. And as the PTO's counsel got up here and said that their rule allows them to determine patentability without looking at the
record. Is that why you didn't argue anticipation still by Schacherer? Because you didn't care? I'm confused with the whole procedure or posture of this.
So the issue, frankly, is that Aqua Products and then the board's subsequent rule flipped the burden of proof. That there was then no corresponding procedural change. So now the petitioner has 25 pages in which to make the best argument it thinks it can based on the grounds that it guesses the board will invalidate the original claims. We had multiple grounds of invalidity at issue on the original claims. We argued obviousness because that would apply regardless of what the grounds were on the original claims. And
okay,
we had such limited space.
Can I just stop? Is there any place in your brief where you specifically argued that the POP's new rule about the board having the discretion to raise readily identifiable grounds was not, that the board didn't properly exercise that discretion, where you argued the POP panel's decision is an abuse of discretion?
I cannot point to a place in our brief where we argued that it was an abuse of discretion. I do think we argued the general principle that in this case it was readily identifiable and persuasive.
Where is that?
It is on page 16
Looking at blue, yellow.
Looking at top 15.
I'm sorry.
Oh, I'm sorry.
I mean, it seems to me all of your arguments were the board, the POP panel didn't do its job of looking at the entirety of the record and all of that. And I know it's this new exception came up in the POP panel, but you could have challenged it on appeal saying even if there's this exception, they abused their discretion in finding that the board's decision didn't meet that decision. But you... I don't even see. I'm looking at your response brief, your reply brief, the yellow. It doesn't even there talk about it was readily identifiable that these were anticipated. It was the board should have looked at the entirety of the record. Is there something in the language of any of those? I'm just looking at the table of contents. I mean, you should know what you've argued in your briefs.
In our reply brief on page 35,
Your Honor, we said the POP decision was an arbitrary and capricious refusal to consider evidence because the facts of this case meet even the narrow discretion test articulated by the USPTO and the POP, but the POP still blinded itself to the evidence. Thus, the board found the ground of unpatentability of the amended claims readily identifiable and persuasive using the record before.
Okay. Is there anything in blue about that? Never mind. Just go on.
And again, Nike says the board must consider the entire record and determine whether or not the claims are unpatentable in the face of the prior art before it. That's all they did. The panel, they didn't do something.
You think, I mean, don't we have rules in our cases? I mean, you can't preserve an argument with yellow. I mean, unless you're saying they were the ones that raised it, you assumed it was in blue, so you clarified it in yellow. But the rule is the argument should be in blue. Yellow doesn't save you if you waived an argument in blue, does it?
No, Your Honor, but I think that this case is ultimately decided by the fact that the POP didn't review the entirety of the record. The board did. We have one opinion that makes a decision based on the entirety of the record and another one that doesn't.
If you don't deal with the cross appeal, your friend doesn't get to respond.
And my only last point is that, I mean, DynaEnergetics just got up and admitted that the whole purpose of their amendment was to respond to anticipation by Shacker, so clearly they had noticed that it was at issue. Thank you.
No, I think, did you hear him respond to your cross-appeal issue?
He did not, Your Honor.
Well, then you don't get to rebut.
Understood, Your Honor.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you. We thank both sides in the case is submitted.